catty comments, nasty jokes, critical jibes. Not all of them, and not all of the time, and it has to be admitted it is only a very recent development since, say, the autumn of 2008, but it will probably go on for a few more years, till the present crisis and the present image of bankers as nasty baddies begins to fade. At the moment, however, when people enter the utterly splendid, totally wonderful, architecturally magnificent Museum on the Mound at the Bank of Scotland's headquarters in Edinburgh, they do tend to let slip the odd sarky remark. The bankers don't help their cause, as immediately on arrival, on your right as you enter the first room, there is £1 million. It's in a glass case, arranged in real cash, neat bundles of it, all in £20 notes, which means, let me see, using the fingers of both hands, there must be 50,000 notes piled up before me. Well, if you are having a museum revolving round money, you might as well show some. Let Joe Public see what £1 million actually looks like close up, as Joe Public is never going to see it in real life. But it is rather asking for comments and reactions, especially in these hard times. "So whose bonus is this, then?" That's one of the more printable reactions. "I've often wondered what happened to my bank charges." "Oh, look, some banker has left his petty cash behind." "Wow, £1 million. Was it really real? That was my first reaction. Or just Monopoly money? No, they are genuine Bank of Scotland £20 notes, each with its own individual and correct serial number, properly printed by the official printers, in this case De La Rue, who seem to print most of the world's banknotes. On closer inspection, I noticed that each note has been overprinted with the word cancelled. So don't bother to break in and try to steal them. They won't be worth much. Though they will be worth something, as the Bank of Scotland, having ordered these notes for display purposes, had to pay for the cost of the paper and printing, which came to around £4,000. My second thought was, is that all? £1 million cash didn't seem physically as vast a wodge as I would have imagined. In fact, you could cram it all into a large rucksack, or one of those outsize wheelie suitcases, and no one on the tube would guess what you were carting with you to Heathrow, hoping for a quick getaway. If that's all that £1 million looks like, I wondered what £19 billion would look like. That figure went through my mind because that was the reported loss that HBOS had rung up before it found itself being taken over by, or at least amalgamated with, Lloyd's TSB in 2008. At least it had not suffered the ignominy of its deadly rival, the Royal Bank of Scotland, which had to be rescued by the government from the gutter or extinction, and whose boss, Sir Fred Goodwin, found himself being mocked and ridiculed as Fred the Shred, and his property daubed and vandalised. Yes, the credit crisis of 2008-9 threw up many dramas and disgraces, collapses and corruptions in the UK and all over the Western, so-called civilised world. In some ways, the worst falls from grace and the most abuse were experienced by those mighty Scottish bankers sitting in their Edinburgh strongholds. For 300 years or so, we had so admired them, almost as much as they had admired themselves, pillars of society and industry and the community, people and institutions renowned for integrity, probity, respectability, and above all, security. In Britain, and in the English-speaking world at large, we had particularly looked up to Scottish bankers as representing, so we thought, the very essence of the best traditional Scottish virtues. Scots are supposed to be canny, are they not? Scots like to be prudent. Scots can be trusted with our money. Think of all our Chancellors of the Exchequer in recent years who have been Scots, like Norman Lamont, Gordon Brown, Alistair Darling. And think of all the mess that Scottish banks and bankers have recently helped get us into. Sorry, we won't start all that again. Let's give them a break. Despite being Scottish-born and spending most of my childhood up to the age of 11 in Scotland, I had never actually known the difference between the Bank of Scotland and the Royal Bank of Scotland, getting them confused when not half thinking they were the same thing anyway. I had also never looked properly at Scottish pound notes. On receiving them in my change, in, say, Carlisle or Cockermouth, and knowing I'm about to go south, I will always try to change them for real pound notes. I mean, Bank of England notes. Feeling rather unpatriotic and ashamed by my behaviour, but knowing that if I try to pay with them in some back street London petrol station, they will be turned over suspiciously by someone who has never seen them before, or Scotland. So, I have always moved Scottish fivers and tenners on quickly, never properly studying them, assuming they are all from the same bank, which would be, that Scottish bank, what's it called? I had never realised that there are in fact three different Scottish banks allowed to produce their own banknotes today. The Bank of Scotland, the Royal Bank of Scotland, and the Clydesdale Bank. These three are the only ones left out of around 80 or so different Scottish banks, which over the centuries have produced their own notes. The Bank of Scotland was founded in Edinburgh in 1695, and started producing its own paper currency in 1696, which it continues to do to this day, making it the longest continuous issuer of banknotes in the world. Others have come and gone, particularly long ago in China, but the Bank of Scotland always carried on, taking over many other smaller banks and financial institutions along the way. By comparison, the Royal Bank of Scotland is an upstart, not being founded till 1727, though over recent centuries it has rather edged ahead, with more capital and more high street outlets than the Bank of Scotland. The Bank of Scotland's headquarters is on The Mound, on the slopes under Edinburgh Castle, one of the city's most prominent and dominant buildings, its dome roof being seen from all corners of the city. The architects were Robert Reed and Richard Crichton, and it was completed in 1806 to universal admiration. The mound was in fact mainly man-made, from spoil heaps thrown onto the steep slopes of the castle when they were digging out the foundations for the new town, and also from the middens and dumps used by the people living above, which were later levelled and built on. The building was extended in the 1870s, attaining the size and stature it is today, with its massive windows and high-ceilinged reception areas and flagstone floors. It had always kept its archives, as it was proud of its history. Banks, almost by definition, have to keep records and accounts anyway, proof of what it is they've been doing with our money. The Bank of Scotland opened the museum to show its history to the public in 1988, devoting one little room to it, but rather half-heartedly, opening only in the summer months and then not every day. This was the case when Helen Redmond Cooper arrived in 1989. She is Welsh, took a first degree in politics at Swansea, an MA in archive studies at Aberystwyth, and then, after a short spell in the Essex Record Office, landed the job as assistant archivist at the Bank of Scotland. She worked mainly in the archive department, but also looked after the museum, such as it was. It was tiny and very amateurish. In 2001, she feared the worst, that their little museum would be swept away when a massive reorganisation took place. The Bank of Scotland got into bed with the Halifax PLC and emerged as HBOS. Banks seem to be besotted by initials these days. I refused for years to call my bank HSBC and still referred to it as the Midland. I never got my tongue round HBOS either, even though I found they now owned my ISA, which I thought I'd taken out with the Halifax. I now know not to worry about bank names. There will be another change along soon. All you have to do is wait. However, Helen's fears proved groundless. She was made head of archives for the new company, taking over responsibility for the Halifax archives. Then the new chief executive, James Crosby, decreed that the whole building on the mound was to be upgraded and refurbished. In 2004 it closed for 2 years, and when it reopened in 2006, a brand new museum was included, with state-of-the-art displays, the latest in design and technology and, most amazingly of all, about 7 times bigger than it had been. Now, with its luxurious fittings, gleaming cabinets, spotless displays, space and grandeur, it reeks of affluence and wealth, as if no expense has been spared. Is that the case? I would get shot if I revealed how much it cost, says Helen. Halfway through, I realized that three rooms would not do us justice, which was the original plan. I was allowed to expand to seven rooms, or eight if you count our lecture room. The bank was generous in terms of the space they were willing to give me and in providing the budget for museum quality conditions, temperature, humidity, lighting, secure cases, etc. The best thing was I had no interference. I was allowed to get on with it as long as I followed two guidelines. The museum had to reflect the whole group, the Halifax's history as well as the Bank of Scotland's, and it had to be accessible and understandable to the general public. In fact, I did have financial constraints. I didn't have enough money to install any audio facilities, though we have lots of video and interactive stuff. I'm not keen on audio as a rule, as it can be disruptive. Sound can seep out from one display when you're looking at a different one and be distracting. But on reflection, I think earphones might have been useful with a taped commentary in different languages. To do that was going to cost an extra 40,000, and I had spent my budget, which, no, I'm still not going to reveal. There was enough money, though, for a grand opening, and they hired the well-known Edinburgh writer Ian Rankin to perform the ceremony. He did get a modest fee, but donated it all to the Edinburgh Children's Hospital, and the bank itself topped it up several times over. Rankin did the museum proud, and came out with a quote that they still use on their website. "The Museum on the Mound is the best new museum to have opened in Edinburgh for ages. It's fun, it's free, it's fantastic." That is its official title, The Museum on the Mound. As if they are perhaps a bit nervous about pushing the notion of a money museum too blatantly, though the title is always followed by the subheading Money and So Much More, and they usually spell the word museum with a pound sign for the E. "It is called the Museum on the Mound," says Helen, "because it is physically located on the mound in Edinburgh, and its subject matter is not just about money. We deliberately went for a variety of themes and topics to give the museum broader appeal." In its first year, it attracted over 50,000 visitors and received a 5-star rating from Visit Scotland, though recently it has dropped to around 42,000. Helen puts this down to the traffic chaos in Prince's Street caused by the tramway works. Having survived, and indeed triumphed, as a result of the arrival of the Halifax and the H-Boss reincarnation, there was far worse to come in 2008, when the credit crunch and recession struck. Again, it did appear cost savings would have to be made, that an 8-room museum, employing a staff of 4, with another 5 behind the scenes in the archives, would be one of the early and easy casualties. The takeover, or should we say forced amalgamation, with Lloyd's TSB, caused by all the debts H-Boss had accumulated, was humiliating enough, but at least they retained their independent existence, as opposed to being taken over by the government like the Royal Bank. Things were a bit hairy when Lloyd's arrived. No one knew what was going to happen, what changes would be made. Lloyd's had their own excellent archives in London, but I also knew they didn't have their own museum, so I looked upon that as slightly reassuring. In the event, the museum has been left largely untouched. I think in the scale of things, with such colossal sums being bandied around, the cost of running the museum was seen as minuscule, hardly worth closing for what it would save. But it was also realised that the museum was a real asset to the organisation. It's a proper, genuine museum, not just a marketing gimmick, which the public recognise as such and want to visit, in their thousands. We also cover so many themes, from death and disease to art and architecture. And our school's programme, which focuses on money, has been a huge success. We also happen to be a free museum. No one can hold that against us, say we are trying to take money off people once again. In her own personal and social life, it was quite unpleasant for a few months. She says people working in any sort of bank at any sort of level did find themselves being attacked and criticised at parties, or when they met strangers and revealed what their job was. It was a sad time. You would have to be devoid of all emotion not to feel personally affected by it all. The public, quite rightly, felt let down by what happened. Few could feel let down by the museum itself, and its 7 display rooms, so lavishly and professionally organised and filled with treasures, even if a lot of them are a bit erudite for someone who has just wandered in off the mound, attracted by the free entry and wanting to make rude comments about bankers. The main emphasis is on Scottish banking over the last 300 years, but they do pause for a while to explain that money has been around a lot longer, and from ancient times onwards came in various forms. Small cowrie shells were one of the earliest forms of currency, as they fulfilled the purpose of most forms of money, to be portable, durable, recognisable and divisible. At one time, red feathers were used, at least in the Solomon Islands, while in Tibet, money was made out of bricks made of tea. In Nigeria, bottles of gin were sometimes used as currency, but could also be drunk, which was useful. There are a lot of ancient documents on display, such as the parchment containing the original act that set up the bank in 1695, banking files and record books, as after all, money is only a document, a scrap of paper, so in a museum devoted to the subject there is bound to be a lot of paper. I happen to like paper, and the more and prettier it is printed, the better. So I spent a lot of time studying the development of banknotes, the vignettes and watermarks, lettering and typefaces, and the plates from which they were printed. Their oldest Bank of Scotland note is from 1716. Earlier ones back to 1696 have all disappeared, probably burned. As for Scottish coins, I had never consciously realised that they don't exist. Scotland has not had its own coinage since 1707 and the Act of Union, but earlier on the Scottish kings did mint their own coins, back to David I in the 1130s. Helen would dearly love to discover a 1696 Bank of Scotland note, which would cost a small fortune if one ever did turn up, though probably not as much as some of the classic US banknotes from the 1820s, which have changed hands for up to $1 million. In 2007, when some new Bank of Scotland notes were issued, a set of 5 of them, £5, £10, £20, £50 and £100, all with the lowest possible serial numbers, were sold for £12,000 at a charity auction held by the bank, despite their face value being only £185. Old Scottish notes don't fetch enormous prices. The week I was at the museum, an 1878 Clydesdale £1 note had been sold for £4,800 at an auction in Carlisle, which was considered a pretty high price. There are banknote collectors all over the world, and the International Banknote Society, with chapters in most countries, has thousands of members. Collectors of Scottish notes have recently broken away, becoming the Banknote Society of Scotland. They currently have about 50 members. I was a bit disappointed, though, by the lack of cheques, which I know is also a keen collecting area. I was going to collect them myself at one time, as in the old days they were so attractive, and then I decided, no, I'll just collect cheques signed by famous people, though that hasn't got very far either. I only have 4, signed by Somerset Maugham, Gladstone, Saul Bellow and Tennyson, plus, I think, Charlie Chaplin, which I seem to have misplaced. The object of money is not to keep collectors happy, but to make the world go round, especially industry and commerce. Over the years, the Bank of Scotland, and all the other banks and institutions it has taken over, such as the British Linen Bank, have served some distinguished firms, like John Brown, the shipbuilders, and famous people, such as Sir Walter Scott, Robert Louis Stevenson, and Thomas Carlyle. In one room, there is a display of documents relating to famous customers, which includes Carlyle's spectacles. Seemed to be stretching it a bit, having specs in a museum supposedly about money, but the label wittily says that Carlyle used them to keep an eye on his money. There is even a poem by Robert Burns, which turns out to be directly relevant to a museum about money, as it was written on the back of a Bank of Scotland banknote in 1786. You could write on the backs at that time as they were left blank before the need for tighter security. The poem is a furious attack about his lack of money being the cause of all his problems, and could very well have been written by some disgruntled people in the Western world in 2009. We worth thy power, thou cursed leaf, fell source o' a' my woe and grief. For lack o' thee I've lost my lass, for lack o' thee I scrimp my glass. The poem continues for another 8 lines, ending rather melodramatically. For lack o' thee I leave this much-loved shore, never perhaps to greet old Scotland more. The reason for Burns's fury was to do with the family of Jean Armour, whom he had made pregnant. Her father found out, took her away, and threatened Burns with jail unless he could find a large sum of money, which he didn't have, hence his plan to emigrate. He didn't, as he then met another girl, Highland Mary, and probably made her pregnant as well. Money, or the lack of it, has always been easy to blame for one's woes. From the beginning of paper money, forgers have been trying to make their own money for nothing, and often succeeded, despite ingenious ways to make it impossible. One of the earliest attempts to diddle the Bank of Scotland occurred in 1700, when a local man, Thomas McGee, was suspected of a very simple forgery. Because the £5 and £50 notes were at that time the same size and colour, all he did was carefully alter the figure 5 and change it to 50. He was called into the bank one evening for questioning, but because it was late and they were locking up, he was allowed to go home, promising to return in the morning for more questioning. In the morning, he was spotted heading south for Newcastle, and was never seen again. A wise move, as up to 1832, the penalty for forgery was hanging. From the moment the Royal Bank arrived on the scene in 1727, they were in deadly rivalry with the Bank of Scotland, and often up to some pretty dirty tricks to gain an advantage. The theory of all paper money, then and now, is that the bank issuing the paper promises to pay the bearer on demand real money, that is, solid stuff, which of course no one ever asks for. But the Royal Bank of Scotland did. In 1728, they started collecting and keeping as many Bank of Scotland notes as they could. When they had enough, some £900 in notes, they trundled them along in a barrow to the Bank of Scotland and said, "Come on, give us the cash." The bank did not have sufficient supplies, and had to close to business for 3 months, during which time they went back to their subscribers to raise more cash. Even when they reopened, they had only £585 in real hard cash, compared with £70,000 then currently circulating in notes. Banks have always taken a few chances. It was a rotten trick by the Royal Bank, so why did they do it? It was just the name of the game at the time, trying to put the opposition out of business, Helen replied, smiling. I'm sure we did pretty much the same. In 1745, when Bonnie Prince Charlie and the Jacobites arrived and took over Edinburgh, the bank was frightened that a similar thing would happen, that the Jacobites would appear with Scottish notes and demand gold and silver in return, to take with them to finance their hoped-for conquest of Carlisle and then London. In this case, the worry was political. Succouring an enemy by giving them money could have counted as treason, so when the bank heard the Jacobites were on the way, they quickly collected all the money they had and rushed off with it to the castle, where it was locked up and hidden. On view in the museum is a massive kist, as chests are known in Scotland, which was used by the bank to lock up its money each evening, plus any gold and silver plate or other valuables. It dates from 1701 and is made of wrought iron and has 2 locks, one at the front and one hidden on the top. You have to press a secret button to reveal the top lock. No bank official would have the key to both locks, so it would take 2 of them each morning, each with a key, to open up the kist. Financial scandals and disasters are not new, as bankers and investors tend to get carried away, usually with other people's money, into unwise decisions. One of the biggest in Scottish history was the Darien Company, which around 1698 was aiming to become a Scottish version of the East India Company, setting up a trading and exploration colony on the Isthmus of Panama in Central America, where it was hoped vast fortunes would be made. Several explorations took place, but it all ended in disaster, with lives lost, families ruined, investors bankrupted. The whole of the Scottish economy suffered, though the Bank of Scotland was not involved. The Halifax and the history of building societies also gets a bit of space, and I learned something I didn't know, which is why the Leeds Permanent Building Society was so called. Originally, building societies were groups of people who put a certain amount of money each week into a pot, out of which in turn they took enough money to build a house. After they had all got their houses, the society was wound up, hence this was called a terminating building society. In Leeds, Halifax and elsewhere, it was soon realised that the society was such a good idea that it should be continued, attracting new depositors, and so the new version was called a permanent building society. There is also space devoted to life insurance, as one of the elements in the present group is clerical medical. You can fill in your own insurance application, stating your name, age, illnesses, where you might be travelling, how much you want to be insured for, and the policy gets printed and given to you when you leave the museum. It's a nice bit of parchment. Shame it happens to reflect prices and conditions in 1824, and states that the policy is void if you die by duelling, but it's a neat piece of personal memorabilia all the same. About the most popular exhibit, enjoyed by children of all ages, is a game called Cracking the Code. You have to reply to certain questions about banking, the answers to which are somewhere on the walls. You then get certain numbers which have to be arranged in the correct sequence, and if you get them right and set the combination lock correctly, the door of the safe swings open, and you can get the gold coins inside. I think I've got that right, but it looked too complicated for me to attempt. The coins are, in fact, chocolate, but worth having nonetheless. Every day, about 10 people manage to crack the code. These and other interactive displays and computer-generated bits of wizardry were presumably not cheap to create, and they were devised specially for the museum when it reopened, and are extremely popular. But personally, I much prefer real objects and genuine relics, such as a brass calculating machine from 1820, known as an arithmometer, which bank clerks used to count up money. I also liked the photographs and documents showing the social life of bank clerks in the 1930s, their staff magazines, their outings in charabancs, their tennis clubs, their subsidised trips abroad. What fun it must have been to be part of a well-known bank in the old days. What status, what pride. Well, you never know, it might all come back again. There were so many documents and paper memorabilia I would like to have had, as I do like printed stuff, and I did like the way that, as with the Pencil Museum, they have broadened out the subject into topics and materials connected with the basic theme, but not directly obvious. It's a lesson we museum creators, well, possible museum creators, should take on board. The building, of course, was stunning, worth seeing for itself, but I don't think I am going to be able to afford such premises. Better stick to the chattel house idea. Before I left, I went round the museum shop and bought a few exciting presents, such as a Halifax tea towel from the 1950s. It shows a wife in a pinny laying the table while the husband in the foreground is saying he has invested in Halifax paid-up 3.5% shares. It appears to be pretty sexist, with the little woman in the background reduced to doing wifely things. But the message from the man reads, "My wife agrees we should invest in the security of the Halifax." So they were in it together, even if it would seem to be her agreeing with him. The Halifax tea towel was reduced to £3.75, as it was not proving as popular as a Bank of Scotland tea towel priced £5, which features a £20 note. People like the idea of drying their dishes with it. I bought several to give to my wife and daughters. I do spoil them. All the profits from the shop, so Helen stressed as I left, go not to the bank but to charity, currently the British Heart Foundation. More proof of how caring our modern bankers can be. Which, in a way, should ensure the museum's future. While other equally specialist, if less well-appointed museums, might fear for their survival, the Bank of Scotland, now under the wing of the Lloyds Group, obviously sees its museum as part of its corporate image. Of all the mad and unlikely reasons for opening and retaining a museum I had been trying to think of before I set out on my trail, I had never envisaged soft PR as one of them. Museums do have their uses. Museum on the Mound, The Mound, Edinburgh, EH1-1YZ. Telephone 0131-243-5464. www.museumonthemound.com. Chapter 14. Chantry Bagpipe Museum, Morpeth. So far, I hadn't visited a council-owned museum. They tend not to support mad things like a museum devoted to one single eccentric subject, though in their town museums they often have an assortment of mad things, most of which have been left to them by local worthies, the idea being that they are displaying a variety of items, all lumped together, showing the tremendous range and richness and general wonderfulness of their town's history. Or not, which is more likely the case. A handful of Roman coins, some Victorian costumes, old pop and lemonade bottles and far too many stuffed birds. That was traditionally how town museums presented themselves. Single-subject museums tend to be the creation of one person who either tries to run it for money so it funds itself, or else pays for it out of his or her own back pocket if they are wealthy enough or have another income. Some manage to find a rich backer to help out, as the vintage radios did for a while, or they turn it into a charity with a board of trustees and volunteers who run it for nothing. Single-subject museums can, of course, be the creation of some sort of institution like the Bank of Scotland, or an industry like the Pencil Museum, or a society like the Clan Armstrong Trust. Then there are interesting museums attached to a university, or to a scientific or medical foundation. I did consider quite a few of them, such as the Pitt Rivers in Oxford, which is a truly amazing museum and was the work of one collector, or the Wellcome Institute, with its marvellous medical relics. But they cover too much, and are too big, too rich, too broad in scope to be classified as either single subject or truly, deeply mad and eccentric. The Bagpipe Museum in Morpeth. That sounded genuinely unusual and strange, though I was a bit worried when I heard it was in the same building as the town's tourist information centre, fearing it would just be a couple of cases in a corner, along with the leaflets for town trails, guest houses, animal farms, kiddies' adventure playgrounds. But I was assured, on the phone, that it was a proper museum, separate from the tourist stuff, with its own curator. Morpeth, today, is an affluent country town in rural Northumberland, not far from the coast, which serves as one of the more desirable commuter towns, along with Hexham, for the better-off professional types who work in Newcastle, about 15 miles to the south. As with Langholm and Ulverston, little country towns that I had never been to till I first stumbled upon their museums, I was surprised by Morpeth's architecture, the historic connections, ancient buildings carefully preserved, a bustling little market in the middle of town, giving a sense of prosperity and well-being. It may all be a mirage, and there were slums and deprivation and drug dens I missed, but it made me wonder why I ever go abroad, when there are clearly so many attractive small towns in Britain I have yet to visit. Shame about the second-hand and antique shops. I found only one antique shop, which looked interesting enough through the window, but it was closed. One good-sized bookshop, Appleby's, but I couldn't see any old books. I was directed to what I was told was a bric-a-brac shop above a butcher's, which I eventually found, but it had been empty for 6 months. I had hoped that with its middle-class residents and nearness to Newcastle, I would find loads for my collections, but no luck. In Cockermouth, which with a population of 7,000 is only half the size of Morpeth and is much more remote. After I had done the sheep show, I found 8 different places selling second-hand treasures. Oh, bliss! The Bagpipe Museum's location, however, was a treasure in itself. A medieval building called the Chantry, beside the river as you cross the bridge into the town centre. The earliest records date back to 1296, when it was a chapel where chants were sung and travellers were blessed on the way north to Scotland. The priest in charge would also take a small fee for letting them cross the bridge. Over the centuries it changed hands and purposes many times, housing a boys' grammar school, a cholera hospital, and then in more modern times it was a pop factory bottling mineral waters and lemonades. Then it lay derelict, allowed to fall into disrepair, until 1974 when Castle Morpeth Borough Council bought the whole building and began to restore it, installing an information centre and a shop selling local crafts and gifts. But it still had space, in fact the whole of the upstairs, to house something else. But what? Enter the sound of pipes, which until then had been droning away, hardly listened to or seen by anybody, some 15 miles distant in the centre of Newcastle. A collection of Northumbrian pipes had been left to the Society of Antiquaries of Newcastle-upon-Tyne, one of the oldest such bodies in the land, founded in 1813. For 15 years, the pipes had been kept in a room in the Black Gate of Newcastle Castle. Despite all the times I must have been to Newcastle over the decades, I couldn't quite remember where the castle was, or even whether they had one or not. "Precisely," says Anne Moore, curator of the Bagpipe Museum. "That was the problem. Even people who passed the front door every day never knew we were there. We were up 3 flights of a narrow and steep spiral staircase as well, which didn't help, and it was always freezing. People were puffing and shivering as they came up the stairs. Then when they got to our door, they were met by a notice saying, 'Entrance 15p. I could then hear them say, "I'm not paying that," and walk all the way downstairs again. Anne was born in Blyth and read English at Hull. She worked at the Lang Art Gallery in Newcastle before getting a job at the Bagpipe Museum on temporary contract. It's how museum curators got a bit of work experience in those days, the 1980s. There was massive unemployment. We seem to be going back to that sort of situation now. The Society of Antiquaries had decided they could no longer afford to look after the pipes. They were being moved to Morpeth, and Anne, who had originally come in to catalogue them, presumed she would be out of a job, but she moved with them. After a year, she was appointed curator, a job she still has. Anne had had no formal training in museums or curating, which back in the 1980s was not always required anyway, but she did a diploma in museum studies at Leicester, part-time. Today there are loads of places where you can take a first degree in museum work, and you won't get far unless you have one, at least if you're working for a council-owned or government-funded museum. The do-it-yourself museums, of course, do not have the same requirements. Anyone can open a museum. You don't even need Latin. Once the pipes arrived at the Chantry, they were properly displayed, a professional designer hired, storyboards printed, and they soon expanded from one half of the top floor to take over the whole floor, and a sound system was installed. When they were in Newcastle, they attracted only a couple of thousand visitors every year, though of course people were being charged a hefty 15p a time. Now they have up to 10,000 visitors from all over the world. Entrance is free, so the figures are estimates. Such are the joys of being properly funded, professionally run. But ah, what goes up on the wall can come down. Being tied to a council means you are also tied to their fortunes, vagaries, fashions, whims, political infighting. At one time, councils appeared as safe and secure as, well, banks, but not any more. They are just as likely to go bust as any other business.
6 years ago, we thought we were about to close as the council had to save money. We are not a statutory service, like emptying dustbins. They don't have to keep museums going. Their finances were about to be officially investigated by central government, and we thought that was it, we would be the first to go. But then a massive worldwide campaign started with appeals and petitions, and emails flooding in to save the pipes. Anne thinks it was because musicians, as a breed, can very quickly get steamed up and become very active. Perhaps it's because they tend to spend half of their time unemployed and like a good fight. But it was mainly the nature of the pipes, Northumbrian pipes, not your run-of-the-mill Scottish type, which stirred up all the emotions. Exiled Geordies in the far corners of the English-speaking world decided they were not just saving some old bagpipes, but their own heritage. So phew, at the last moment, the museum was saved. Then came drama number two. In September 2008, Anne had been on holiday for a week. She came in on Saturday morning, not normally a day she is at the museum, to catch up on some paperwork. Out of the corner of my eye, through the windows, I noticed that the river was quite high, but I wasn't worried. The river often is quite high. After all, we've been here for 800 years, so you presume we must be safe enough. Next time she looked, a couple of hours later, the river had burst its banks, come across the little stretch of garden, and was flooding into the Chantry Building, straight through the 800-year-old stone. There was apparently no damp-proof course or deep foundations. They thought at first it was seeping under the doors, so they closed them. Then opened them again to let the water out, when they realised how it was getting in. When I got downstairs, the water was up to my ankles. Outside the door it was up to my knees. I quickly found help and began rescuing all the pipes. Although the museum proper is upstairs, they had a small display downstairs as well, plus a storage room with around 60 instruments, and all their archives. A piper, who was coming to play that evening, offered to come and help. She brought her daughter and her brother too, and on their way down the street they managed to rope in another friend who happened to be passing. It took us 4 hours, but we managed to carry everything upstairs to safety, by which time the emergency services ordered us all to evacuate the building. The whole building was closed for 6 months, during which the pipes were moved to another museum 6 miles away. The building was then totally refurbished, refitted, and redecorated. When I arrived in August 2009, it had just officially reopened, with Princess Anne doing the ceremony. It was all gleaming, the new paint and display cases sparkling, but alas, the sound system was still not yet working upstairs in the museum. In normal times, you can put on earphones, and as you go around each display case, you can hear the exact music made by the pipes you were looking at. What they hadn't realised was that the floodwater, which had ruined all the plaster on the downstairs walls, had also upset their sound system. However, it was all working not long after my visit. Fortunately, as Anne Moore was about to take me round the museum, a real piper arrived, Maureen Davison. She had recently retired from working in the graphics department at Northumbria University, and she had also lost her house after a vehicle smashed into it, so she was spending a lot of time practicing her pipes in the museum to amuse herself and the visitors. She had first heard the Northumbrian pipes as a child when they were used as a jingle on Radio Newcastle. I fell in love with them then, but it was about 30 years before I decided to learn how to play them. She now plays semi-professionally, when she can, at weddings, funerals and parties. Like most people, at least outside the northeast, I had no idea what Northumbrian bagpipes were and assumed, as most people do, that all bagpipes look much like Scottish bagpipes, so it was interesting to see her open her case and assemble her set. They call it a set of small pipes, and it does come in a set of 4 different pieces. The strangest part was the bellows, which looked exactly like fireside bellows, which she strapped on under her right arm. I asked if left-armers put it under their left arm. She paused and thought. No, she had never seen people do that. The bellows always goes under the right arm, as you can see in the ancient illustrations. The wind from the bellows then goes into a bag held under the left arm, which is made of leather with a cloth cover, and from there the wind goes into the chanter, on which the tune is played, and also the drones, all of which extend from the bag. The drones, as the name implies, drone on, giving a background harmony hum. Maureen had four of them sticking out, which she adjusted slightly before she began. The big technical difference between Northumbrian and Scottish bagpipes is that in the former, the air comes from the bellows as opposed to the mouth. The chanter also works on a slightly different principle, having the end closed, so the fingers have to be lifted and replaced individually to make notes, giving the characteristic peas popping sound. The Northumbrian pipes also have keys, which give them a wider range. Finally, the Northumbrian pipes are smaller, quieter, sweeter, and are meant to be played indoors for dancing or festive occasions. The Scottish pipes are louder and were used for marching, going into battle, and for sending signals and conveying emotions across long distances from hill to hill. There is an old Scottish proverb which says that 12 Highlanders and a bagpipe make a rebellion. So, who invented bagpipes? Ah, said Anne as she took me round, if only we knew. Surely the ancient Chinese, the Egyptians, or the Greeks and Romans, they must have had them. As one of them always seems to have got to everything first, from central heating to football. Strangely enough, bagpipes as we know them, and as I went round I found more variations of bagpipes than I had ever imagined, are mainly restricted to Europe and North Africa. In these regions, almost every little country or area had at one time its own form of bagpipes and played its own traditional bagpipe music. Bagpipes have been made and played in England for 800 years, though they were originally a bit simpler, and every region, every county had their own types. Not all of them used bellows, as the Northumbrian pipes do. This seems to have come in around the late 15th century. There is a piece of sculpture from 1480 at Hexham Abbey that shows the pipes being blown from the mouth. The change to using bellows was probably pinched from France, where bagpipes were seen as a court instrument favoured by the king. They were very popular under Louis XIV, during a period when rustic peasant music was all the vogue. Vivaldi and Handel composed music that imitated the sound of pipes, though not many famous composers created music directly for the bagpipes. Pipe music was not written down till the late 17th century, and pipers had to learn tunes from other pipers. Quite a few well-known artists like Watteau, Bruegel and Dürer have featured bagpipes in their works. In England, in the 16th century, pipes became the instrument of the common people, while the toffs favoured lutes and virginals. It was considered a bit vulgar to have bellows under your arm, and bagpipers generally were thought of as drunks, rogues, and disreputable travelling players who would get up to anything dodgy unless you watched them carefully. One of the earliest English descriptions of a bagpiper occurs in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, which dates back to the 14th century, where Robin the Miller, usually depicted on his horse playing the pipes, gets drunk and frequents whores and harlots. When Maureen had finished playing, and I politely clapped, I asked her what the tune was. It was called Jamie Allen, named after one of the more colourful characters in the history of the Northumbrian pipes. He was born in Heppel, Northumberland, in 1734, his father a piper and his mother a gypsy. In his early days, he seems to have been quite respectable, invited to play at Alnwick Castle, home of the Duke of Northumberland, who traditionally has always had his own personal piper, and still does. Jamie Allen took the king's shilling and joined the army, but ran away after he had got it. He then rejoined the same regiment, which wasn't very cunning, to get another shilling, and went on the run again, becoming a travelling piper, usually with a gang of cronies who picked pockets while the crowds listened to Jamie playing. He was convicted of horse stealing and landed up in Durham jail. His many fans, admirers of his piping, petitioned for his pardon. The Prince Regent finally agreed to a free pardon in 1810, but it arrived after Jamie had died in jail. In 1817, a book was published about his life story and legends entitled James Allen, the Celebrated Northumbrian Piper, containing his travels, adventures and wonderful escapes in England, Scotland, Ireland, France, Holland, Arabia, etc. His Arabian adventure sounds more like legend than reality. Today, Northumbrian pipes are the last remaining regional pipes in England, still actively played, listened to and studied. In places like Worcester and Cornwall, once well known for their local pipes and pipers, the art has died out. Anne thinks one reason they have remained and flourished in Northumberland is because of the region's remoteness. There was a great revival of interest in them that began in the late 1920s and 1930s, and local Boy Scouts and school cadet corps were encouraged to take up the instrument and use it when marching. The Northumbrian Pipers Society, first established in 1928, has 800 members today, and there are probably the same number again who are piping fans, hence the avalanche of letters when the piping museum seemed doomed. There is also the Alnwick Pipers Society, formed in 1977, and Northumbrian Pipers Societies in North America and in New Zealand, so the instrument is now global. Scottish bagpipes come in three forms, Highland, Small, and Half Long, and are, of course, still more popular and better known around the world than the Northumbrian pipes. But the Northumbrian ones are all handmade, so there. Some Scottish bagpipes, said Anne with a slight shudder, are now being mass-produced in factories in places like Pakistan. Northumbrian pipes are individually handmade by local craftsmen and are not cheap. Maureen said her set would cost about £1,800, but you can get a set for £500. Because they're individually made, they are all slightly different, which makes it harder for Northumbrian, unlike Scottish, pipers to play in groups, though Northumbrian pipe bands do exist. There are about six full-time makers of Northumbrian pipes, one of the best known being David Burley, who set up in business in 1972. There are also three full-time professional players, Catherine Tickle, Andy May and Pauline Cato, all of whom have recorded a lot of their music. Catherine Tickle, who has recorded with Sting, is the best known and has built up a national name and reputation. The exhibition starts off chronologically, from the time of Chaucer, though Anne has a theory that they could have started with the Romans, as she believes that Nero played the bagpipes. Traditionally, he played the fiddle, but I think tibia utricularis suggests a kind of chanter. Shakespeare has a reference to bagpipes in Twelfth Night, but doesn't give details of their type. When we came to the French display, which shows a musette de cour from the court of Louis XIV, she insisted that it probably, possibly, maybe, was the one that the Sun King played himself. There is a painting in Versailles that shows him playing a very similar set, and at the end of the chanter in the museum's set, there is indeed an image of the Sun King. Most sets of bagpipes have their maker's name, so they can be identified and dated. The museum also has a set that was decorated in 1806 by Thomas Bewick, the great Northumbrian engraver, whose son, Robert, played the Northumbrian small pipes. The whole museum has been updated and improved since the flood. A new glass lift and disabled lavatories installed, thanks to the council having proper insurance, which a single-person privately owned museum might never have been able to afford. In the second room, they now have what appears to be a large embroidered rug, showing three stained glass windows. I carefully walked round it, but Anne said, no, I had to walk on it. That was the point. As I did so, stepping on each window, bagpipe music started playing. Not any particular tune, just different bits of bagpipe music, interspersed with the chime of the original chantry bell. The image of the window turned out to be projected from a camera above, while the music was triggered by some unseen sensor. All dead clever, very high-tech and arty, and no doubt pretty expensive, but it seemed a bit out of place and unnecessary. I like museums that have solid, genuinely fascinating objects, and stick to showing and explaining them, not dazzling us with technology as if they fear our attention span will only last 10 seconds. The headphones for listening to the bagpipe music as you wander round, though I didn't have them that day, would seem perfectly sufficient, plus the occasional real live piper. However, they don't appear to have paid for what they call the Cantaria, as it was part of some project that began at Sunderland Cathedral. The museum was also given anonymously £7,000 to spend on some modern brand-new bagpipes, specially commissioned, of different types, which are in cases at the top of the stairs, so you can compare the old pipes with the new. These new ones are all playable. All you have to do is ask, and convince Anne that yes, you know how they work. Now that does sound like a useful hands-on addition. Anne herself can play, but is self-taught. She felt she had to learn if she was going to be pontificating to other people on the wonders of the Northumbrian pipes. She does think they are wonderful, a sweeter sound than any other form of bagpipes. She obviously gets a bit jealous when Scottish bagpipes appear to get more publicity and reverence. She noticed recently on the soundtrack to the film Rob Roy that they had not used a Scottish pipe. On one soundtrack, I could clearly hear Irish pipes being played. Oh yes, I know the difference and can recognise each one by ear. Rather sad, I suppose. Even sadder, I could often recognise the player as well. Some modern British composers, such as Peter Maxwell Davis, have written music specially for the Northumbrian pipes. I was surprised to find just how thriving all bagpipe music has become, all over Europe. In their excellent souvenir guide, they have a map of Europe and North Africa that shows all the countries where bagpipes are played today and their local names. They get many foreign visitors to the museum, and very often they turn up with their own set of pipes, from France, Germany, Italy and Holland. They like to compare them with the Northumbrian versions and give Anne a bit of a blow. France appears to be the most bagpipe-conscious country, with many regional types still being played, and lots of regular festivals and competitions held every year. But every country has at least one variety left. Anne is particularly fond of the Dudi from the Czech Republic and the Gaida from the Balkans. The museum also has a small display in honour of the man who created the collection in the first place, William Alfred Cox. He left it to the Society of Antiquaries on his death in 1971, on condition that the pipes were put on display for at least 15 years. He must have known or feared what might happen, as it was exactly 15 years later that they began to look for a new home for them. Anne says little is known about him, though he died so relatively recently. He was a bachelor, a bit of a recluse who avoided publicity. He was a keen member of the Antiquaries, and when he had written a learned paper for the Society, he got another member to read it out. He collected many other things, mostly of an antiquarian nature, as well as old documents, photographs, and memorabilia to do with bagpipes. In 1924, according to a letter from Buckingham Palace, he made a miniature set of Northumbrian pipes, just 1 inch long, but perfect in all details, which were presented to Queen Mary for her doll's house. He was a master clockmaker by profession, but Anne suspects he must have had private means to have been able to afford to buy several hundred bagpipes and related objects, many of them rare. I suggested that, being a bachelor with no family to support, he was in quite a good position to indulge himself if he didn't otherwise spend a lot of money. I know quite a lot of collectors of modest means who have managed over the decades to build up pretty valuable collections by having the time, energy and a good eye, yet only a small purse. The collection has been added to in the last 40 or so years, with donations and the occasional purchase, and now consists of 150 sets with around 60 of them on show at any one time. They once bought a set at Sotheby's, the set engraved by Thomas Bewick, which was made by John Donne, a famous pipe maker of the late 18th century. They paid £3,500 for it, the money coming from the Society of Antiquaries and the V&A. Mr. Cox would no doubt be very pleased that despite a dodgy moment or two in the 1980s, when the collection could have disappeared from public view, and later when it might have been ruined by floods, the museum is now one of the most thriving musical museums in all Britain, and wins awards and gets rave notices. There is even a website set up by Friends of the Bagpipe Museum. I'd like to have friends of my museum whenever I get round to it, like the Tate or the National Gallery. Wouldn't that be useful? Sort of reassuring, bestowing status and indicating that it wasn't all just a personal indulgence. It obviously helps if your museum has cultural overtones, preserving something that local people value, and you have enthusiasts for the object itself, in this case the bagpipe, which people like Maureen are more than willing to come along and demonstrate.